Hello, and welcome to Media Ministry at Holden Village. Today's date is July 22nd, 2004. Today's session number is DYL-2004-03. The speaker for today is Laurel Dykstra. The lesson for today is The Other Side of Exodus, Exploitation of the Earth, Exploitation of Humanity. Let's listen in.
So let's start with who we have, and if other folks show up, we'll be reasonably nice to you. My name is Laurel Dykstra. I'm here at Holden Village for 2 weeks. I'm in the middle of my first week doing a class on Exodus and reading Exodus from a first world perspective. Most of the work that we're doing in this class is from the book Set Them Free, The Other Side of Exodus, which I wrote, which is available in a bookstore. Just sort of quick information stuff. Last class we talked about modern slavery and ways that we participate in slavery in the modern world. And some resources are available in the Resource Center if people want information about things mostly about just buying, I think. Did you want to speak to that?
Yeah, primarily. Yeah, and corporate responsibilities. Yeah, there are three files. They're sitting on the table, and then plus there are some other reading materials that are just laid out.
The book Disposable People is sold out in the bookstore, the book by Kevin Bales on slavery and the global economy, but as I said in the previous class, it is a new edition will be coming out within the next 2 or 3 months, so just if you wanted to get that book and didn't, be aware that you'll get the new edition. So I've noticed that I've been introduced to a whole lot of people since I got here, and there's a special little part of my brain where people say to me, hello, my name is, and it goes whoosh. So I thought I would try, rather than we just go around and say our names, that we say our name, and then the group will say it back. Huh? And maybe that will help it stick. Mm-hmm. So I'm Laurel.
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 I'm Yvonne.
Yvonne.
And Ruth.
Ruth. Ruth.
And
Diane.
Diane.
Hanifa.
Hanifa.
Asaph.
Asaph.
Joyce.
Joyce.
Karen.
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 Jan.
Jan.
Diane.
Diane.
Laurel, that reminds me of the first day when you had us repeatedly reading the Exodus passages. Mm-hmm. I've never seen that technique, and it was wonderful. Uh-huh. We just kept going and going, and it percolated, and
oh, good,
excellent.
Pedagogy is working. Okay, so the next part of the opening introduction exercise is that we're going to go around the room, and today what we're looking at is primarily from chapter 5 of my book. It's about how violence against the environment and violence against one another is related. But what we're going to do is kind of look at that through the lens of the plague narratives, the story of the plagues in Exodus. And so I want folks to fix in their mind a plague from the story of Exodus. And then shout it out. And don't worry if somebody's taken yours, we'll just repeat it. So we'll just go one at a time, starting from this end. Joyce.
Locus. That's exactly what I was going to
say. Yes.
Okay.
Was there a frog one?
Locus.
Asaph.
Fleas? Were there fleas?
I was going to say locus.
I can't remember. Was there a death of the firstborn?
There were snakes, didn't there? Blood or something.
Blood. Well, I heard somebody say snakes. I'm going to write that down.
Yeah. Blood.
Water turned to blood.
Okay, I want to make sure that everybody's had a turn. So, Diane?
Well, I just said, death of the firstborn.
Oh, yes, you did.
Yeah.
It's working. I have read my earlier names.
Yeah, I not only have others in that room.
Okay. But which one did you think of when I said
that? I immediately thought of locusts.
Okay.
Blood.
Okay. So, we've got a list of plagues. We're going to look at the plagues a little bit further. I'm going to do a bit of a teacherly thing and talk about sort of how I came to looking at this approach. In the first class, I talked a little bit about a man named Robert Warrior, an Osage man, Native American, whose big beef with Exodus is that liberation theologies leave out the Canaanites. And that as a Native American man, that the people who are most like him and who he has sort of the most reason to relate to are the Canaanites in the story. And that especially Christian readers need to keep the Canaanites central to our reading because they're the last unheard voice. And then he has this throwaway line, except maybe for the land. Which caused me to think, well, what is the voice of the land like? I'm just going to close this window because it's I can only see half of your faces. So Robert Warrior talks about the unheard voice of the land. So hopefully this will be a little bit of a chance to look at the land or issues of environment through Exodus. Walter Brueggemann, who's probably the most important Old Testament scholar living today, let me tell you exactly what he says rather than giving you a paraphrase. He says, land is central, if not the central theme of biblical faith. And this is sort of my interpretation of what he's saying. For Israel, a nation born in the wilderness, land belongs to Yahweh and is Yahweh's gift and promise. But land is a dangerous gift. With land, people become subject to the management of the land and are no longer subject to God. There's an underlying tension in Scripture between obligations to the land and the freedom to live the land, which is also a tension between farmers and herders. So throughout the Bible, good land is depicted as agriculturally productive, domesticated, and controlled. Curiously enough, parallel to the themes about land that is productive, domesticated, and controlled, are themes about the productivity and the fertility of women. So we're looking at some of that in Exodus. Okay, now for a pop quiz. Locusts were very, very popular, and there are some reasons for that. How many plagues are there?
Ten.
Okay. The Passover Haggadah lists 10 plagues, and traditionally we sort of think of there being 10 plagues. Let's see, we've got locusts, frogs, fleas, death of the firstborn, snakes, blood. So 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Any guesses on what's missing?
Hail.
Pardon?
Hail.
Yeah.
Hail is one. Well, the truth of the matter is, much like the Ten Commandments and the 12 tribes and all of those other special biblical numbers, the 12 disciples, it's actually hard to tell what are the 10 plagues. And there's a couple of reasons for that. But the main reasons being, well, let's see. One of the...
Boils.
Boils, excellent.
I think fleas is not a plague.
Pardon me?
I think fleas is not a plague.
Well, in fact, there are two separate plagues of insects. So insects occurs twice. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's translated fleas, sometimes sand fleas, so you're right on. There is a cattle epidemic.
All right.
Mad cow disease?
Yeah.
But there's also some stuff that happens when God is commissioning Moses. It happens before the plagues, but follows the same pattern. The way the plagues go is sort of like this. God instructs Moses, says, go to Pharaoh and tell him to let your people go, more or less. Moses goes to Pharaoh and tells him. Pharaoh either refuses or doesn't do what Moses asks. Then the sign, wonder, or plague is described. And then frogs filled up the land so that they were in their mixing bowls and so that they were on their heads, and even the king's bed was filled with frogs. Pharaoh then calls Moses back, asks for intercession, The plague is taken away. Pharaoh changes his mind. And the state of Pharaoh's heart is described. So those are kind of the elements. Some of those elements occur in some of the magic stuff that God tells Moses to do beforehand. So there's with the throwing down the rod that turns into snakes, that follows the same pattern.
Floods.
Yes, flooding the land is also follows the same pattern. There's two different psalms that seem to refer to the plagues in Egypt, and they each have, being 78 and 105, and they each have a list of about seven plagues, but not the same seven. And like I said to Asaph, the fleas, or the biting insects, or bugs, as I so nicely call them, appear twice. So what it seems like is there's a variety of layers of different tellings of this story altogether. Let me tell you the sort of best part about that. It happens to the poor cattle. The word miknei, cattle in Hebrew, is a broad term, and it covers animals ranging from sort of from goats up to camels and everything in between, so horses and cows and cattle. And so along with the rest of the population of Egypt, human and animal, cattle endure polluted water, frogs, two kinds of insect inundation, and then, perhaps mercifully, all of the Egyptian cattle are killed in an epidemic that strikes flocks, herds, and transport animals. Dead, they escape the boils, but when the hail comes, Egyptian cattle in the fields are again struck dead. The final blow, the angel of death kills all the firstborn of Egypt. This includes cattle. And yet, curiously, a short time later, there are still horses, which are under the heading of cattle, available to pull Pharaoh's chariots. So you can see that there's layers upon layers here, and kind of the historical stuff that tries to make scientific explanations for how all of these things could have happened in a natural but unusual year are kind of a suspicious argument, because the whole point of these stories is that this isn't natural. That something is wrong in the environment, that the world is acting in a way that it shouldn't. So I think what we'll do now, and anytime the recording person can stop recording, is what we'll do is we'll do small groups, maybe three, and we'll look at three different plagues. Locusts, because you like it so well. Death of the firstborn, and frogs, because I like the plague, well, frogs. And I'll give you some references for that, but why don't we just sort of group up into three little groups here. And I think I'm going to say, just take a look at those sections. It's chapters 7 through 12 of the book of Exodus, and I will come around and give each group a precise assignment. And then I'll give you some more specific instructions in a little bit. Would you like to be locusts?
Of course.
Alrighty. Exodus 10, 1 through 20. Oh, also, I just realized we skipped the plague of darkness. Darkness covered all land. A darkness you could feel. We may be death of the firstborn. Exodus. Somebody should write this down.
This part.
10, 1, 2, 3, 4. Oh, okay. This one's on the agenda right now because it's two different places. 11, 1 through 10, and 12, chapter 29, 13. Maybe I'll go right there. Okay. And we put our frogs. You're not in person. Exodus 8, 1 through 3.
Study the passage.
Just take a look at it together.
Okay.
Further instructions will ensue. Okay.
a little bit of a mysterious assignment, and I'll tell you kind of how I got there. When I was doing, sort of reading this section of Exodus, I came across some writing by a woman named Yvonne Guevara. She's a Latin American liberation theologian. She's also an eco-feminist theologian, and she's written a book called Longing for Running Water. And here's what she said, and maybe you'll see why I felt I should think about the plagues. The eco-feminist issue is born of the lack of municipal garbage collection, of the multiplication of rats, of cockroaches and mosquitoes, and of the sores on children's skin. This is true because it is usually women who have to deal with daily survival issues. So over the past 20 years, and increasingly over the past 10 years, women from a number of different traditions have been looking at the connections between the material conditions of women in their culture and how the earth is treated and understood in their culture. And kind of over time, those discussions have gotten more complex, more nuanced, taking into account economics, race, class, culture. Some eco-feminist principles that folks who are doing this kind of work from are the notion that humans aren't the center of God's creation, that God is not separate from creation, that economics, race, and class are vital to understanding gender and environmental justice, that all faith traditions can learn from one another, that the land and all creatures are sacred, that the earth is fragile, that the logic of domination and the promotion of suffering must be opposed, that humans are at home on the earth and dependent on it. The earth is not our enemy, and we didn't come from somewhere else. Humans have power for healing and creativity. Each of us has the right to meaningful work. Bodies are important. The earth's body, human bodies, and the bodies of all living creatures. The lives of women and children, especially the poor and people of color, are important. The earth, the lives of women, and the connections between them are not to be romanticized. And that theological work must support grassroots political movements. So out of some sort of those principles come particular eco-feminist questions. And some of the questions that would be applied to a text such as the plague narratives are, how are women portrayed? How is the non-human world portrayed? How is the divine portrayed? What are the relationships between all of these? So maybe if folks from the different groups could say what you noticed sort of looking at those stories and looking at those questions. And for now, we'll sort of make it a report back rather than a question.
I think we were uncomfortable with how God was portrayed.
How was God portrayed?
Well, that God would harden Pharaoh's heart. The comment was, so does God harden the hearts of the presidents of the multinational corporations that go in and rape the land and move on so that we all can learn from it? You know, is there something there? You know,
I saw that as him being more egalitarian too, because he didn't put up with, he wasn't willing to compromise on having just men being sent out. For him, everyone had the right to leave. And at least in the locust story, they were, Pharaoh was saying, you can send them out.
You're making two different points, and they're really good, so let's they're really valuable.
There's a counterpoint to that point about the Lord hardening Pharaoh's heart. If you look at the end of each of those, it alternates between saying, Pharaoh hardened his heart,
yes,
and the Lord,
yes,
hardened Pharaoh's heart.
Yes.
So
yes,
it was sort of, that was the direction Pharaoh was inclined, and God kind of, you know, cooperated in him going that direction.
I actually have a breakdown somewhere, and I'm not going to pull it out for what that is. But that's definitely one of the interpretations, is that it starts out by God and then, no, it starts out with Pharaoh. And then there's sort of a number of God hardened, Pharaoh hardened his heart. Pharaoh's heart was hardened, and God hardened Pharaoh's heart, and that's the progression. So there's a variety of ways to look at what that means.
We were just uncomfortable with that. God of the Old Testament, that you see kind of those kind of questions of, oh, is this the God that we really want to know? We kind of found a lack of women being acknowledged, really.
So you found lack of women being acknowledged.
Which is shame, guys.
Yeah.
Okay. And you were making a point about Moses.
Somewhat not related, but just.
No, it was really good.
Well, and I'm trying to figure out how I can link God hardening his heart, saying maybe he wasn't ready yet, that Pharaoh wasn't ready to make his decision equal among all Israelites that needed to be let go. So he wanted, he was okay with the men leaving, but the women and children and the goats and the whatever herd that they had to stay, because he recognized that group as, at least from his perspective, as being valuable, and he didn't want them to go.
So can you explain a little bit the passage for folks who are not sure where you're reading from?
Okay, he said to them, the Lord indeed will be with you if ever I let your little ones go with you. Plainly you have some evil purpose in mind. No, never, your men may go and worship the Lord, for that is what you are asking. And they were driven out from Pharaoh's presence.
Okay, so Moses says, oh, we have to take everybody. And Pharaoh says, no, the men can go. So that there's some mention of women, if only by elimination.
Right.
And that Pharaoh recognizes the importance of women, perhaps.
See, I would take that just the opposite, that he would think, Pharaoh would think, well, only men worship. Women don't even do that, so the women don't need to go. So you men go do your church thing, and the women don't even participate in worship, so they can stay here.
Church being invented some number of centuries
ago. Yeah, well, whatever. You know.
And my understanding from something you had said is that women were just the carrier of the seed, and so without the men, there wouldn't be another race.
So let's hear some more of what people noticed about portrayal of women, portrayal of God, portrayal of the mother.
I didn't notice this the first time I read it, but it was one of the only mentions of women that we saw. But what he's doing is he's talking about who's going to die of the firstborn. Mm-hmm. So he ranks them from the greatest to the least. And the greatest is the firstborn of Pharaoh, who sits on his throne, to the firstborn of the female slave who is behind the handrail. So the lowest of the low is the female slave.
No, because then he goes down to cattle.
Well, yeah, but of humans.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, there's definitely, there's a hierarchy involves humans and non-humans.
So it's not just slaves, but gender and slaves.
Yes, and gender and.
Well, that's interesting then. So why would he want to hold them?
No questions.
What?
No questions.
Oh, okay. I was asking you.
Observation.
Oh, well, observation. Okay, it's interesting to me that he would want to keep the women and let the men go then if they are really not valuable. Although you said he thought that they might be valuable.
Right.
I think they're valuable in the form of slavery and usage to their own kingdom, and also integrating within their own culture.
I think Pharaoh's using them as hostages.
As hostages, or asking slavery. Yeah.
But it was not only, you know, it was the men, it was not only the women he was going to keep and the children, but also the flocks.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, clearly Pharaoh knows our answer. Never mind. We'll talk more. What about the non-human world? What did you notice about the portrayal of the non-human world? Paul Webb kind of benign?
Well, the frogs were everywhere. Mm-hmm. The frogs group has been kind of quiet so far.
Tough.
Yeah. Frogs.
And when the Lord corrected the inappropriate distribution of frogs, he confined them back to just the Nile. It was very specific about where they belonged. They certainly did not belong in people's mixing bowls and beds. That's mostly what the theme of the non-human world is.
So that it was where it didn't belong and back where it belonged?
Yeah, although they died in heaps. I mean, they died and were kind of swept into heaps, and the land stank.
So something's out of whack.
Mm-hmm. Totally unbalanced.
And we noticed that women weren't mentioned, except that we felt that women were in there in the ovens and the kneading boards.
Oh, that's interesting.
So yeah. Women had a very definite presence, and that the frogs were certainly affecting the lives of women. They're just not mentioned.
I think we're probably more bothered about the frogs in the beds.
Yeah.
maybe if the locust folks could talk about portrayal of the natural world.
Powerful.
Mm-hmm. I think there was kind of a sense from Pharaoh that he didn't really recognize the power.
Or didn't take it seriously.
Yeah.
And now kind of interrelationships between those things. Are the power of nature, for want of a better term, and power of God related?
From this it appears that way. I mean, because God has the power to send the locusts or take them away.
Mm-hmm. I think that we relate them by like things in insurance policies that say, covered except for an act of God or something.
Interesting.
Yeah, God is, I guess the relationship is God is acting through them.
Things that I would like to kind of draw out or point out, the plague narratives are really a contest between God, the God of Israel, and the God of Egypt, who is Pharaoh. And so this is there's a concerted effort in some aspect of the editing to show the power of God. But that's really, really important, is that God is powerful. Everybody pretty much got the, this doesn't tell us very much about women. So that's another point that I would want to kind of draw out from this. And the other one about the natural world is a little more complicated. The world is divided into the natural world that is domesticated and serves us and is victim in this story, and the natural world that is wild and that is ammunition in God's battle. And so that's sort of part of the portrait that's going on.
It's funny though that particularly in the frogs, Pharaoh has people that bring frogs up too. What's
yeah.
that about?
Well, some of that is a particular priestly argument. Pharaoh has priests, and there's a contest between the priests of Pharaoh and the priests of Israel, who are the Aaron. So Aaron is sort of the representative of the priestly class. So sort of that's our magic is better than your magic. Also, the theme that we talked about in past days, Pharaoh's not very clever. So both of those things are going on.
But also the magicians, they're sort of a quid pro quo, a tit for tat, mm-hmm. and they give out at the frogs, and they can't produce the gnats. And then by the time we get to boy, and in fact, at the point of the gnats, they say to Pharaoh, this is the finger of God. So they already recognize they've lost before Pharaoh does. Mm-hmm. And then by the time they get to the boils, the magicians, along with the rest of the Egyptians, are afflicted by the boils. And so they really know they've lost.
So they're kind of increasingly ridiculous. And there's a little bit of religious polemic there. You know, that Aaron is a priest, but they're magicians. And so there's a little bit of a kind of a religious slam going on there. To say, you know, that clearly Yahweh is the more powerful God. So emphasis on power, not on the, you know, not on the mercy, not on the loving kindness of God in this portrait. Next class tomorrow at 6:20, we're going to talk more about like violent portraits of God and how do we deal with those. So let us move to, we've got about 20 minutes left. So maybe let's do 4 minutes of questions. If folks are sort of holding on to things that they're like, can you just tell me about this thing? So we'll do about 4 minutes of those, and then on to kind of looking at what might be some modern parallels. What are ways to look at this story that might help us look at our own lives now? Questions? It's fine. Right then, let's talk about, is that okay to move on yet?
Yeah,
okay. So let's talk about what might be modern parallels. I heard somebody saying, you know, the hard hearts of multinational corporation heads and some stuff there. What other kind of parallels can people think of?
Well, when you were talking about, which I haven't thought about before, you kind of pointed to it was, you know, the battle between the power of God and the power of Pharaoh. I mean, I feel like there is a battle, may not be God of the Old Testament, but there's a battle between God and between, you know, science and technology, and that's a battle nowadays that people are, you know, can we just do whatever we want with the earth and we don't have to pay any attention to God's will or nature or however you want to paraphrase that. Can we just rape the earth and then...
Mm-hmm. So one thing I neglected to mention in sort of pulling out themes is that one of the understandings of the people who were creating this story is that that the human world and the non-human world are intimately connected, mm-hmm. and that a rupture in one, so injustice, causes a rupture in the other, frogs out of control. Yeah. So that there's a causal connection there, mm-hmm. that we don't need to posit that there's a causal connection between you know, oppression of humans in the modern day and oppression of the natural world or abuse of the natural world, to know that they're still related. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not like the earth is fighting back.
Right.
We don't have to say or believe that to observe that when we treat both humans and non-humans as commodities, right. that those abuses are interrelated. So yeah. I just wanted to highlight that.
Well, and I would take that one step further with naming the fact that the earth is called Mother Nature and how women are abused just as the earth is abused. Because it is feminine.
There's certainly, yeah, there's a history of looking at those ideas that are kind of at the root of some of the eco-feminist literature.
You posed this as a sort of warfare between Yahweh and Pharaoh and the natural world as ammunition, and that got me to thinking about the way that humans have used nature as ammunition in a sense. The way in the Vietnam War, the Viet Cong were using foliage as ammunition, and so we struck back by defoliating. And in Iraq in 1991, you know, Saddam Hussein lit fires so that the smoke would be, you know, like the darkness in Egypt. It would be part of the ammunition. And, other examples, some of the things that were done to the Pacific Islands when the tide was turning, you know, these desolate landscapes that were just caused by the warfare.
Yeah, the and there's parallels like with the fires in Iraq, and also with the sort of the campaign of sanctions, that the results are really parallel. That any campaign that's designed to devastate has some of the qualities that the plague narratives describe.
It's also interesting that as we push manufacturing and jobs and so forth out into places where people have less rights and are less well cared for, at the same time, another advantage is that those places don't care so much about environmental controls. And so basically, it's very interrelated. If they care more about their people,
don't care so much, but I think that
the people aren't able, and the countries and the governments don't care because they're in collusion.
Yeah. Under the NAFTA and also under one other of the international trade agreements, there's provision for corporations to sue countries if their environmental regulations present an unfair barrier to trade.
You can buy and sell how much pollution.
Yes. Yeah, with the sort of repealment of the Clean Air Act, there's provision made that this much pollution from coal-fired power plants or something that I know that release mercury into the air and that is building up in the food chain, and that's really a severe risk for poor women, because tuna is made available through the WIC program and also through food banks. Yeah. And it's something that stays in a body once it's in and builds up in the food chain. That poverty and environmental danger are very connected. In the United States, the single factor that's sort of a most likely predictor as to whether you will live near toxic pollutants is race.
Mm-hmm. And close to even things like landfills. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Sure.
And in South America with the pesticides too, and the water, it's usually the poor that live in those areas where the water runoff is mostly from.
Well, the thing with women, I don't know if it's changed too much. I mean, I think of baby girls in China are still aborted or adopted. Or, and even as equal as we claim we are here, we still aren't. Mm-hmm. And compared to the other places in the world.
There's another piece we haven't looked at all. I'm thinking of rainforest, and the drive to cut the rainforest and grow is not being done by multinationals as much as by people who have no place to go because they're overpopulated. Mm-hmm. So the population problem is also a big factor, and I'm not, we haven't talked about it, but it must play in here somehow.
Mm-hmm. Well, yes and no.
Yes and no.
Because there certainly in this story, the swarming and the reproducing of the Israelites is seen as a gift of God. Seen as a good thing.
Plus.
That there sort of wasn't a risk at that point.
Yeah.
So, yay and nay, I would say. But kind of a modern parallel to really the invisibility of women in the story. And it's really, there's points in Exodus where it's doubtful as to whether, women are included in the people or not. When God self-reveals on the mountain, God says, get everybody ready. And Moses says, everybody get ready. And God says, tell everybody to come. Moses says, everybody come. God says, tell everybody not to have sex with a woman. It's like, wait a minute, who's everybody? If everybody Oh, all right.
And yet, you know, there's the role of Miriam in the whole story.
Yeah, and there are clear examples of women doing great stuff, and there are also clear examples where women aren't part of the people.
Which is probably a reflection of the people that wrote it down, I would think, and their values.
Well, I haven't read the earlier part of that text, but now that I'm reading it again, mm-hmm. So we will go with our young, or, no, but which ones are to go, Moses said. We will go with our young and our old. We will go with our sons and daughters and with our flocks and herds. There's no mention of women. Yeah.
This is from a book by, that, I can't remember her name. She's a woman who was one of the first members of parliament in New Zealand, a young woman. Does a lot of economic work. Basically, she became Minister of Economics in New Zealand, and she knew, you know, diddly squat at, you know, young 20s about economics. And she was like, okay, well, I'm the minister, teach me. And started to look at it and kind of start asking questions and unpack stuff and realized that a whole lot of people did don't count as production. And then there's a lot of ways that our women are invisible economically. So she writes, consider Tende, a young girl in Zimbabwe. Her day starts at 4 a.m. when, to fetch water, she carries a 30-liter tin to a borehole about 11 kilometers from her home. She walks barefoot, and she is home by 9 a.m. She eats a little and proceeds to fetch firewood until midday. She cleans the utensils from the family's morning meal, and she sits preparing lunch of salsa for the family. After lunch and cleaning the dishes, she walks in the hot sun until early evening, fetching wild vegetables and firewood for her family. Then she makes the evening trip again for water. Her day ends at 9 p.m. after she has prepared supper and put her younger siblings to sleep. According to international economic system, Tende is unproductive, unoccupied, and economically inactive. She does not work, and she is not part of the labor force. So that, and the stories of some of the women that we talked about yesterday in a class on slavery and sex trade, are ways that women are invisible to one another even now. So they're sort of parallels in that way. We're getting close to the end of time, so I sort of want to invite the last comments before we do, before I read a piece to close with. Other examples that you can cover, other similarities between sort of that connection, that environment, justice.
You mentioned what we do to the earth and what we do to women, and then you're talking about the Zimbabwe thing. Some of you have heard me say that I lived in Zimbabwe, out in the reservation, horrible, desolate, worst awful land there for 2 years with mostly women and children. And I was just thinking about that. We were talking about the land, that what they've done to the women there because the men have left to go try and find work is, you know, first they tell them you have to live out here, and then there's no way to really be productive. And then the women go out and chop every little stick and branch and tree they can find to cook food for their families. And then we're trying to tell them you can't do that anymore because you've deforested the land. And they say, how do we feed our family? I mean, it's just this ongoing cycle. And that's what I was just thinking about was, yeah, that's exactly what it was in Zimbabwe. The women and the food and the land. And it wasn't that the women didn't care. It was that they had to feed their children.
They had no options.
Well, there was that choice. It's the choice thing. And I remember one time riding with three Zimbabwean women in our little pickup that was our ambulance, coming back from an outreach clinic. Beautiful sunset. Oh my gosh, look at that sunset. It's beautiful. And the women said, can't eat it. You know, they're thinking about feeding their kids. You bet. Mm-hmm. You know, and so, you know, just that, I guess, I don't know where that all fits in, but the land and the women and the children and what's happened in all that is interesting. You know.
Hey, I guess this is sort of a parallel that I see, and where it goes, I don't know, but, you know, when you got the oils, and then to be a biological worker, and it's
I was thinking about AIDS.
Yeah, and you think about that, and who that hurts, and, I mean, it's just sort of not very fun.
It might be a stretch, but I know some theologies compare the earth to the Christ being the suffering servant, and now the earth is the suffering servant. And something I wrote at the end of it, it was like, so will Mother Nature rise again, or will she just be sacrificed? Because if we continue this way, well, I don't know. It probably humans will die out before the earth.
I worked, interestingly enough, with a group of women locally, actually, in the States, that are prostitutes with HIV and AIDS in children, who were totally abolished from family, church, and all. And there was a community of 50 people in one city that I worked with. And we served those people for years. And the only resources, they had no resources. They could not get resources, whether it's through the government, housing, food, or shelter. It was just horrible. And through a church group or an AIDS project program, we organized housing for these people. We furnished food and shelter a weekly for all of these families. And this is right in our own country, you know. So there's a lot around us, I think, that if we look at, we can really see. And I did a 5-year project with them. It was very big hardship. And then you see these people dying and no one caring for them or anything. So it's really sad.
Hello, Johanna.
Just kind of, you were mentioning the woman from New Zealand, and I just wanted Marilyn Ware.
Yes! Marilyn
and so we have this video in the resource center called Moose County, which is exactly
she's like
exactly
a great
the
video. And her book, I think, is called Economics as If Women Counted, or else that's the subtitle.
Yeah.
That's she is quite excellent. Thank you. I love it when people run out.
Yeah.
So, a poem by Martha Shelley by way of closure. Maybe old Egypt was lucky after all. So what if the Nile stank of blood up for a week? Year after year, our rivers run excrement, effluent, profit, and poison. The Egyptians scratched lice and snapped at gnats, and when the locusts devoured the crops, they netted the critters and fried them for dinner. We're fool enough to poison the bugs and the birds that eat them, and our wheat as well. Their cattle died, and frogs overran the land. Our cattle overgraze, and we burn down the forests to feed them. We've developed chemicals that eat the sky and kill all the pretty little amphibians. Our frogs are rarer than princes. They had boils, and we have AIDS. They had hailstorms, but everyone gets some bad weather. We could bear the blows of heaven and earth, even endure a child's death, bear all evils but the two that cause most misery, human greed and human cruelty. It is 6:06. Thanks for coming out. Thank you. Next, tomorrow at 6:20, we will talk about violent images of God and how we look at those and think about those and.
Thank you. Thank you.